So, Nua Al-Sadir, I'm assuming that a lot of you have already come across the book already. It's on sale. You can get it signed afterwards. And if you haven't started reading it yet, the first immediately striking feature of the book, I think, is its title. Fourth person singular, which is an interesting formulation. Somebody in my house, whom I won't specify any further, saw the book on the kitchen counter the other day and said, but there's no such thing as a fourth person singular, which is technically absolutely correct. But I wonder then if you could tell us a bit about what this formulation, kind of this invented formulation is, and how we should understand it.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I had to finish teaching. I teach at NYU also. I had to finish teaching a week early and the semester and grading and everything to make it here in time for the launch in Liverpool last week. So my students knew that I was leaving because I had a book coming out in the UK. And one of them said, I heard you wrote a book in fourth person singular. What even is the fourth person singular? And I think that it is, it's a good question. I was going through a period when I was trying to figure out what speaker to write my poetry out of, because I found that the poetry that was most moving to me was in the first person. But, and that's my measure for the value of a poem, if I can feel moved by it. But at the same time, I didn't want to write poetry about my life or myself concretely. And so I was trying to figure out how I could write in the first person using my life but without writing about my life. And as I was struggling with that problem, I was asleep. And in my dream voice said, the fourth person singular exists in the fourth dimension. So when I woke up, I wrote that down, and then I, like my student, thought, what even is the fourth dimension? So I looked it up. First I looked at the fourth person singular and realized that it didn't exist. And then I looked up the fourth dimension, space-time, and there's a lyric essay in the book where I work it out, but essentially if you can imagine, I'm drawing a diagram. Four-dimensional space-time involves a moment in the present, an event that physicists call P, and then two light cones. One is the past light cone and one is the future light cone coming off of the moment. And the past light cone involves all events traveling at or below the speed of light that could affect the event P in space and time, and the future light cone involves all the events traveling at or below the speed of light that could be affected by P. And everything outside of it is the elsewhere. And if something is in the elsewhere, it doesn't mean it can affect a moment in space and time, but it will only get there after a lag. So the famous example is, if the sun were to lose all of its light, because the sun is in our elsewhere on Earth, it would take 8 minutes for that event to travel into our future light cone and for us to experience it on Earth. So then what I was thinking about was, what if you could replace P, the moment in space and time, or an event with I, get it? And then it would be the self, a self that wasn't bound by a singular moment in space and time, but involved past and future light cone of our psyches and even events in the elsewhere that could affect us. So that the self I think of now in this moment in space and time isn't bound. And that's also what some people think about when they talk about quantum entanglement. All events and people around us affect us. We're not really contained the way we think of ourselves being contained when we identify the I or the self. So it created possibilities for me. And this book isn't theoretical. And I'm not trying to literally write out of the fourth person singular, but there's that fragment in the book where I talk about Hemingway's process. Hemingway would write all the details around an event, say a bomb exploding, and then take out the event and leave only the reverberations. And in a sense, I'm paying more attention to the reverberations and the effects than the events themselves.
Yeah, the Hemingway quote is beautiful because it reminds us that the I that replaces the P, it's not a metaphorical move. It's not I on the model of P. It's not the time of the self on the model of space-time. But actually, they have the same logic. It's something that's kind of more precise that you're describing. Having said that, I don't want to sort of move too quickly into this expository register because, as you said, it's not a theoretical book. And the most important thing about this or any book of poetry is that you actually have some experience of its texture and of its voice, which is indeed very, very singular, as anybody who's dipped into it will notice. And so I wanted to just sort of get you to... We're going to punctuate this conversation with bits of reading. The first part of the book is made up of, well, these extraordinary stray lines, which sometimes seem aphoristic, which sometimes seem like stray thoughts, which are uniformly enigmatic. And one of my favourite things about the book, actually, is not just its content, but its movement. The fact that it takes us on a journey through different registers of thought, of consciousness, of inner experience. And it eases us in a way quite lightly with these fragments of the mind. I'm just going to read one that I particularly love. Which won't take long. I paced back and forth like indecision in an old movie. This is very beautiful and maybe a cue for you to read a bit from this first section.
Sure. And thank you for that too. One other thing about the first section that I'll say, I mean, I feel like I could hold it up, but I don't know if everyone would be able to see it, is that I have a number of redactions, so there are lines that are crossed out, and there's text beneath the redactions, which actually drove the press crazy because I was editing the text beneath the redaction, so you can't see it. You can see some of it. Some of it is light enough so you can read what's there, but some of it is completely redacted, but even the completely redacted parts I wanted to edit because I felt like they were still going to emit meaning and they would still come through even if you didn't get that meaning linguistically. And I also at first thought that the press is really interesting. Liverpool University Press Pavilion is an imprint that Darren Rees-Jones has been running and she's been doing an amazing job. And one of the advantages is we each get, each of the authors, an intern who's a student at the University of Liverpool who works on the book. And the person who was working on my book, Natalie, was amazing. And I asked her if she wanted to just redact from the passages that I was going to redact so that what showed through and what didn't show through was more arbitrary and I wasn't controlling it. And she either didn't see that or didn't get it, so then she redacted everything. So then I actually went back and chose what was still going to be revealed. But it was arbitrary what I revealed. So there's a question of when I read it, what do I do with the redactions? So I think what I might do is just read what's revealed. This is long. What do you think I should do? Read some?
Just get us going.
Dip into it.
Say 3 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah. We're going to keep reading now. I won't be the last author.
The door to my interior was propped open and a fly buzzed in. To repossess my thoughts as a car gets repossessed if payment hasn't been made. But what kind of debt is owed and to whom? The photos on the wall of his house, dashing then death, like the moment before fainting, the voices on the car radio shifting from the rear to the front speakers, subito fortissimo then, cinco. I stood in the loudness of my thoughts like a cutout, superimposed onto the background scene. Shots of sidebar and all. Transparency interests me, wrote Louise Bourgeois in a notebook. I want to be transparent. If people could see through me, they could not help loving me. Forgive me. Why do you talk so much? What is it you have to hide? All of my attention is on a hangnail. I move it to feel the pain. Objects that are near remain out of grasp. I said I couldn't, and all subsequent text messages were click, click, chop, shrubs, nothing out of order. I smell it the way I smelled you were hiding something yesterday, or a child can smell infection. Washing lettuce, how the wet leaves sag like the face of propriety when it smiles. No contraction of the M orbicularis oculi, no movement in the lower eyelid. Don't waste your energy and time, which belong to God, throwing stones at the dogs that bark at you on the way. Ignore them. Norman Mailer marked this passage in his copy of works by Jose Maria Escriva on a bookshelf in his dining room. The small pocket, merely decorative, is sewn shut. No place for holding. Some people are like that. Sewn pockets. Can't hold a thing. In the 1980s, Coke ran an advertising campaign that involved collecting bottle caps. Each cap had a word or a letter written inside, and if you collected all the caps necessary to read Coke, the real thing, you'd win a spectacular prize. The trick was to flood the market with a seemingly infinite number of bottle caps, with the words and letters to the words, Coke, the, and thing, but limit access to the real. Yet maybe it was more lesson than trick. In Jacques Lacan's triad of the symbolic, the imaginary, and the real, you also can't get at the real. The psychic market is similarly flooded with the imaginary and the symbolic. It's not about Coke, the actual drink, but the transcendent experience you imagine in drinking it, as well as the message you're drinking Coke will transmit to yourself and others about who you are. Maybe it's impossible to get real, and that's the million-dollar revelation. Why did they care so much, all the king's horses and all the king's men? Was nothing else happening in the kingdom? Was Humpty Dumpty somehow important to the greater good? Or was it the impulse to put the pieces back together again? Revert to an idyllic image of cohesion. Avoid fragmentation at all cost. Picasso's faces are Humpty and lost. Tonight I will go out with the face of shatter, cubist celebration, without hankering to cohere. I want to be at least as alive as the vulgar.
Okay. It's quite difficult, actually, to extract those fragments, to hear them in isolation, because the effect of their insertion into the whole is that, quite importantly, they're not bits of theory that cast light on everything around it, but on the contrary, they're almost made more obscure, those bits of theory, by what's around it. They become, like everything else, kind of fragments of dream, of obscurity. That relates somehow to the question of redaction, which literally obscures.
And which in psychoanalysis is so important.
Right. Well, I had two thoughts that I guess are intimately related. One, of course, is the association to the Freud's great metaphor in the interpretation of the dream, of censorship, where the dream basically is on the model of a redacted book or poem. It is a text with stuff taken out of it, and we don't know what it is, because the extraction is not something that's been done to an original text, but it's kind of part of the text. Now, the thing about that aspect of the dream that's redacted is that it is whatever it is we don't want to or can't see. You can says, the real that we can't get at. But that brings in the other term that organizes this collection, which is shame. And specifically what you call lyric shame, which has something to do, I think, with the writing of poetry, of a lyric voice, as intrinsically shameful. That might or might not be a congenial notion to everyone listening here, the idea that there is something shameful about speaking out of a lyric voice. Could you tell us more about this?
Well, how I was thinking about it was, I guess I should explain how I was thinking of what I was calling lyric and what I was calling shame. So, lyric, I'm using simply as when an I addresses a you. And the you can be real or imagined or another part of the self. It doesn't have to be another person. And shame I was thinking of as when you look at yourself through imagined eyes of another. So whereas guilt, you're looking at yourself through your own ethical perspective. Shame, you're looking at yourself through what you imagine is someone else's perspective. And actually, just to punctuate, I'm going to read... I have these sketches in the book, which are... one of them relates to this directly, but I'll just say as an aside, there was a period when I was going to artist colonies a lot, residencies, where it wasn't just writers, it was also visual artists and composers, and I found myself unbelievably envious of the visual artists, especially the painters, because I felt like if they didn't have an inspiration, they could still sit in their studios and play music and stretch a canvas or mix paints. And I'm sure it's not really like that, but this is my fantasy. So in my fantasy, they can always be productive even when they don't have any kind of inspiration. And I was talking to a friend who was a painter at one of these colonies, and he said, well, if you're envious of the process of the painters, why don't you just figure out what you're envious of and bring it to your own process? And one of the things I started to do was to carry around a sketchbook. And instead of trying to sketch drawing or figures or anything that I saw in a visual sense, I created what are verbal sketches. And so some of them are in the book, and this is one of them. Sketch 37. On the way home from a walk, my dog likes to return to spots he has pissed on, to smell and sometimes lick his markings. Such joy goes into this sniffing, while Zizek describes the revulsion most of us feel in perceiving our interiors erupt into the external world through the example of saliva, which we constantly produce and swallow inside our bodies. Imagine, he proposes, a scenario in which someone tells you to spit into a glass, then drink it. The thought is repulsive. Your insides are to remain hidden, even from yourself. The lyric is that saliva in a glass. But what is it incarnate? So when I wrote this, I actually was out with my dog, and as he was, I just had a poem published in a magazine, and I saw it, and I just felt incredible shame. And then I walked my dog, and he pissed on a spot, and then as we passed it going back, he was sniffing it, and I thought, it's just like my poem, but he's enjoying refinding it in the external world in a way that I just can't feel the same pleasure at. And I think it is that feeling of having something that was once internal to you presented to you in the external world as though it's external to you. And actually, it reminds me of, I was listening to a scientist on the radio. I'm sort of an obsessive NPR listener, which is an American thing. But I was listening to this entomologist talk about, he was working on these crickets that he described as crickets on steroids. They were really huge and aggressive, and they would bite, and they even had to be kept in separate cages, because if they were put in the same cage, they would attack each other. And he said that he noticed that when they were in their cages, they would create little homes, and they would create beds and nestle into them. And he thought it was sort of sweet, and he started to feel real empathy for them, and he noticed that they could identify their own scent, their own pheromones that they released, because if they were moved into another cage, they would notice that they weren't in their homes. And one day, he had to take them in and out of the cage with a tool. I'm sure you're wondering why I'm talking about this, but I'll relate it. He had to put them in and out with a tool of their cages because they would bite him otherwise. And so one of them he was putting back in its cage, and it was really quickly sort of sneaking out of the cage. And so he shoved it back in and slammed the lid shut. And as he slammed the lid shut, he injured it, and he had cut its abdomen open, and he described the viscera as this yellow stuff that was oozing out. And he felt really horrible. He's like, oh my God, I've heard it. And then the cricket and he sort of both froze. And then he said the cricket turned towards its abdomen and started to eat the viscera. And the radio host said, oh, that's disgusting. And the entomologist said, yeah, it's disgusting because I thought of him as a self that I was empathizing with, but actually in nature it's really hard to find fat. And so it was really smart of him to eat the fat to survive. And I thought of that also in a few ways, like in terms of, it is like we think it's disgusting, and Freud says in The Uncanny that aesthetics like to concern themselves with what's beautiful or sublime, but the opposite pole, which is what's repulsive and distressing, we don't look at as much. And then there's Whitman, who said, I find no sweeter fat than sticks to my own bones. Like, he was like more cricket. But the shame is that sense of, like, your viscera is oozing out, not only before you, but before the world to see, and it's so humiliating.
It's a particular kind, a particular kind of inflection of ooze, isn't it? Because the thing about, I mean, you said this to me on Saturday, that the weird thing about the saliva example, of course, is that, you know, we're all right now swallowing our own saliva. So what is it about this, you know, small external journey from the saliva into the glass, a few inches? What is it that transforms it into something so unpalatable? And it seems to have to do with the objectification of our insides, the sense that we suddenly see ourselves from the outside. You know, it's no longer bound up with and integrated in our sense of our interior. Now, this, I think, feeds into a question about confession and confessional poetry, because it's, as you say, a collection that is about and is lyric. It comes from a very singular individual voice. And it seems to have quite an intimate relationship in all kinds of ways with what we would call the confessional tradition. You know, there are echoes, hauntings of the confessional tradition, I think, running through the book. And yet, the book is not in the way that, say, Berryman or Plath are. It's not straightforwardly confessional. It's not disclosing. We're not going to find out a lot about Nuala Sadir's life, cooking habits, personal history by reading this book. The saliva gives a clue to the kind of revelation this is. Maybe I could just sort of move us a little bit into our other practice, because we both practice as clinicians. And I think of both, and many people in this room may have had the experience on either side of the couch, of kind of charging the analyst reproachfully with something like, I can't bear this because you risk nothing in here. I sit here pouring my guts out, watching my saliva pour into the glass and having to stare at it, and you stare at it, but where's your saliva? You know, you share nothing, you risk nothing. And one of the most difficult things about being in that situation is you kind of can't defend yourself at the time. You can't give an account of why indeed you are risking something here, because it sounds defensive, but we can do it here now. There is a kind of risk involved in sitting in the analytic chair, and it's not unrelated, I think, to the kinds of risks that you're taking in this book. It's not the risk of disclosing yourself in the sense of, you know, the content of your life, but you are disclosing something. You're disclosing the workings of your unconscious. So I wonder if you could respond to that and say something about it and how you experience lyric as what kind of disclosure you feel it is.
Well, in the analytic sense, as you were talking, I was thinking about, even though it's true that someone you see clinically doesn't necessarily know the details of your life, they know you the way a child knows you. And my children, I have two daughters, even from the time they were really little, they know me so well, to the point where we can bump into someone on the street and I think, I've been lovely. And then they walk away and my daughter will say, why didn't you like her? I thought you liked her. And it's just every move. Or I remember there was a phase when one of my daughters used to say, are you mad at me? I would say no. And I wouldn't be. And then time would go by and she'd ask, are you mad at me? And I'd say no. And it was this phase when there was a lot on my mind. And then one day she said, are you mad at me? And I said, no, I was just thinking. And she said, oh, I get it. Your thinking face and your angry face are the same. So then she would ask, are you mad at me? Or are you just thinking? I'd say, I'm just thinking. But I think there is that way in which the Anna Lizanne knows you at that level, where if something is wrong, they can pick up on it. They can read it. They can smell it. It's a very primal relationship, and they know the way your mind moves, or they'll come to look for why you went for what you went for, especially with a dream, for example. If someone brings in a dream, and if I dare address a specific portion of the dream, suddenly it's like this exposure of me. Why did I go for that particular part? And I think it's also true that what is more exposing of a person in analysis and more useful for the analysis is to see how their mind moves between thoughts and feelings. The least productive session, I think, is when somebody comes in with a story that's very narrative and just tells you how it made them feel. If you have, like, one thought and one feeling. When I was first training, I remember being taught, if someone gives you only thoughts, ask for the feeling. If they only give you feelings, ask for the thoughts. Because you always want to know how someone's mind is moving between them and what it goes for next. The stream of consciousness. And I think sometimes lyric poems can have one thought and one feeling. And then it's like an insect that's pinned on a board. Whereas if you have movement between thoughts and feelings, that it goes somewhere really unexpected, it can go through someone's life and the details of their life and be confessional, but it's more about the mind and the emotions than it is about the content.
And I guess also, and this brings us back to poetry, about a particular kind of contact or communication. Lacan says something about you know, difference between what Freud calls communicating unconscious to unconscious and communicating ego to ego. And I think that's what you're describing, that in a way, when I relate a content which the analyst then hears as a content and has a thought of, well, that must have been nice, or gosh, that must have made you angry. Really what's happening is a kind of skimming off the surface of consciousness, which is basically what you can do in the pub. The reason that we do something kind of singular and strange, like go to an analyst or read a poem, is because we're looking for a different kind of contact and a different kind of voice.
And we're looking for the unconscious to be stirred.
Yeah.
And maybe when I say what makes me find a poem valuable is that it's moving, maybe I really mean that it's stirring something. Mm. Not a specific way of being moved, but I've been provoked. And it's a little bit like, Josh knows this, and I know some of you here who I know this as well. I've also been working forever on a book on laughter, a nonfiction book, and as part of my research, I went to clown school. And it was the clown school of, like, Lecoq and Philippe Gollier, and what brought me there was I had been going to a lot of stand-up comedies, storytelling, and what I started to realize was a lot of what people were on stage were giving the audience wasn't dissimilar from what I would hear in a session. And the only difference really was the context. And when people laughed, it wasn't because something was humorous, but it was because it stirred something inside of them. That the interior of the person that they'd revealed somehow stirred the interior of the person in the audience. And clown, it does that to an extreme degree, where when somebody laughs at a clown on stage, they're not laughing because something is funny in the sense of humorous, but because it's honest or true, or it stirs your interior. And actually, this psychoanalyst, Bion, has this really famous line that an analyst should enter a session without memory, desire, or understanding. So you're always approaching a patient anew. And in clown, it's very similar. When you, as the clown, get on stage, you're not supposed to use memory. So you're not supposed to use something you've used in the past that's worked. You're not supposed to have desire to want people to laugh at you. And you're not supposed to use understanding. You can't work with ideas because you're not communicating with the audience at that level. What you have to do is really get up on stage and see what comes out of you. And that in the social ego-to-ego world is the most vulnerable position to be in, because most things that come out of us that we haven't willed to offer to others are shameful or humiliating. But in that context, it's provocative, and then that someone else has the vulnerability to reveal themselves, it does stir something in the audience. And I think that, especially now, because I think that's why humor's gravitated to this area, because we're so concerned with our exteriors and our profiles with social media, that I think it's a relief, in a sense, to feel like your interior is allowed to make its way out, even if it's by proxy, through someone else.
Yes, it is. You're talking about a kind of movement of so much comedy and humour towards shame, actually, towards the kind of the increasingly sort of anti-upping exhibition of moments of shame.
Letting your viscera come out.
Yeah, sure. Did you ever watch the first iteration, the British iteration of The Office?
Yes,
because I remember when that watching the first program, really kind of happening upon it. And it's actually hard now to describe the kind of cultural earthquake that it was, because it came on without much fanfare, and I certainly didn't know what I was watching. But, the laughter was very much as you were just describing. At first, I didn't laugh because it was funny, but because there was a kind of horror of being confronted with a truth about the kind of naked vulnerability of the person that seemed at the time absolutely staggering. Of course, now it's become so established, so internalized in the culture that, you know, we're all quite blasé about it. But this word provocation, I think, is really interesting, because it describes, I think, so many gestures that we're talking about, the gesture of the clown, but also the gesture of the poet and the gesture of the analyst. A lot of people, I think, have the notion of the analyst as a kind of masterful figure. Again, Lacan, you know, had this idea of the analyst is the subject supposed to know. You invest the analyst with this godlike authority. But one of the things that makes her so apparently divine, if it does, is that we have no idea what they're thinking, what they're feeling, or what they want, really. Particularly at the beginning of an analysis. So one of the things that an analyst does is just say, well, I'm here if you want to talk to me, if you want to start responding, which is, in a way, not just a strange gesture, but quite a vulnerable one. It's akin to the kind of, we don't often think about it in those terms. And it feels to me that that's how you're talking about poet as well. You know, the lyrically shamed poet.
That's interesting because we were, I saw Josh on Saturday and we were thinking about what we might want to talk about. And maybe you should explain the LaPlanche. I found this so interesting and it relates to what you said. Mm. Will you?
Yeah, sure. The French analyst, Jean LaPlanche, has this notion that we often think about the relationship between poetry and psychoanalysis as one where, if you like, psychoanalysis is in charge. It tells us what's happening in the poem. And the poet then is the kind of on the couch, you know, it's the analysant to the analytic critic.
And here, so the reader would be the analyst.
Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of how we traditionally think about it. I'm going to analyse a poem, which of course an idiomatic word as well as a psychoanalytic one. We're going to analyse the poem. And he says, look, if you think about the analyst actually as just making this very enigmatic gesture of saying, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to listen, and you can throw anything at me that you want. You can tell me anything you want. You, if you like, can get very angry with me, or you can say nothing, or you can burst into tears, or you can start laughing, or you can tell me some completely trivial anecdote. Whatever you want to do, I'm here. It's a strange kind of offering. And he models the poem on that kind of offering. In other words, it's more like an analyst to us in the sense that it provides us with an opportunity to respond. It stirs up something in us which can take us in all kinds of different directions. And instead of asking to be explained by us, in a way, it kind of dispossesses us. It makes us no longer sure what we think, what we feel. So that kind of disorganizes us. That's the idea. And I think I came up with it in our conversation because it seemed to overlap irresistibly with the idea of a fourth person singular.
Yeah, and then it would provoke the reader's unconscious. And it is like the clown who also provokes the reader's unconscious or interior, and that's when it's marked by laughter, but it's not necessarily funny.
Yeah.
It's like a puncture, and then some of the audience is just, now I'm going to keep using that.
The viscera, I think, is also the way that we are confronted with our own responses. You know, in the face of cruelty, we laugh. And the discomfort comes, I think, from, in a way, the immediate aftermath, you know, the afterblow of the laughter, where we think, well, why did I laugh at that? What was so funny about that? And it shows us some kind of, you know, eruptive strangeness in ourselves that's suddenly in front of us. You know, why am I so nasty, or why does that make me so sad?
Tears are really big in analysis.
Yeah.
I mean, I see many people who will cry, and if I say, what are you feeling right now? They have no idea. And it's not that they have no idea because it's not meaningful. It's because it's the most meaningful. What's being stirred is so profound that it doesn't have the ego-oriented knowledge of that's this, or I can point to that. I can make sense of it.
Yeah,
you can only feel it.
It's not uncommon to see people in therapy or in analysis who sort of cry through most of their sessions, really. Not, in other words, in response to some particular content of thought or feeling, but because there is something about the encounter itself that stirs up some intense rawness, vulnerability, anger sometimes as well. But it is very strange, well, this completely rudimentary gesture of just sit in front of me and feel free to use me as you want. It's extraordinary what it does to people. And that does seem to me to have a lot to do with particularly what takes us to books and to poems as kids.
That's interesting.
Yeah. That you know, when we're kids, our favourite books seem to offer us something, to show us some aspect of ourselves that in a way illuminates and clarifies us, but the most thrilling thing about it is that it surprises us. It in a way, it introduces us to our own strangeness and our own complexity.
And then when you go back and you read that book, it's a totally different book.
Yeah.
How did that stir so much up?
Can we have a bit more? Maybe, I mean, the last part of the book relates to this very nicely because it's got a heading of autobiography. And it's a very, I guess in this climate, this literary climate where the autobiographical is so important, it so dominates the literary landscape, it's a really interesting word to use. I don't know if you want to read first or talk first about it. It might be nice to read that, to hear a bit of that.
I can read it. I'll just say that one of the fragments, and the book is mostly a book of fragments, and one of the first long poem is all fragments, and one of them is, dreamt I wrote my autobiography, the pages were blank, the text in footnotes. So the autobiography is in footnotes, so the pages are blank and all the text is actually in footnotes, and it doesn't go on that long because one of the things about this book that I thought about as I was putting it together, I'm going to sound as though I thought about it a lot. The truth is I was getting really close to the deadline, and I had a month, and I climbed into a deep hole, and I barely got out. I think I must have worn the same cutoffs and tank top every day, and I was waking up at 5 in the morning, going to bed really late. I felt of myself like Sylvia Plath's neighbor at one point checks on her as she's writing the poems in Ariel and reports that her hair smelled of animal. I think I must have also been that, in that kind of a state. But so now I'm going to sound really intelligent about something that really I just wrote out of a different place. But I did think that in doing this autobiography of footnotes that the reader would get the point after a few pages, and I didn't really need to continue it. Because that's one of the things about an idea like that. I feel like if I continued it for 30 pages or for a book, it really would have just been filler. And I would have been trying, I don't know what, to support the idea with material or something. So I'll read some of it. Maybe all of it, we'll see. Autobiography. With an upside down A. I wonder if the person who found my notebook is now having thoughts that I've repressed. Childhood. Loved and unknown. As I lay in bed reading my struggle, A mosquito flew towards the page. I tried to close the book on it, but it darted away too quickly. I stayed up much of the night trying to refine my prey, but no seeum. That is my struggle, unseeing, or rather seeing than no seeum seeing. Can't sleep, can't eat, can't sleep. I'm burning in the St. Augustine way. To Clinton Hill then I came, burning, burning. A little bit wild, close to the core, hyper-live. I have just returned from a party of which I was the life and soul. Wit poured from my mouth. Everyone laughed and admired me. But I went away, and the dash would be as long as the Earth's orbit, and wanted to shoot myself. The phone rang, but there was no one on the other end. It threw me, untethered, out of orbit. I cried while washing dishes, my head full of light, like the Savers discount line. The spider in my ear. My daughter's fear of what's inside me is really a fear of what's inside of her, all of us, and may crawl out at any second. I can taste the mollusk but can't find the room. Lost time. Eros. Nothing seems to matter, have weight, up with the baby at night, sleepwalking the day. A spoon floats at the same level as Ecce Homo, a bottle of white out, no gravity, meaning gravitas. The realization that I'm invisible to the people I'm close to, invisible only to those one step away. Self-congratulation. Bucket of mop water dumped into the sound of applause. There will be no revelation. Only seaweed in your bathing suit. Awareness of the endless not me that can be pulled off your naked skin and tossed away. New Year's Eve. There are 4 minutes left in the delivery window. I wait for a new oven that has been about to arrive for 6 hours. Now I have one of those redactions that I don't know what to do with. I'm going to skip it. Panic is a...
It's there.
Panic is afraid tether. What is it tie me to? If I have almonds, I will eat almonds. But if I don't have almonds, will I think of them? Do we think of what we don't have? Or is thinking a kind of having, having a kind of thinking, as with the characters in Gulliver's Travels who carry the objects they need in conversation in sacks on their backs. If you want to let go of something, you have to let go of the thought of it. Last night I dreamt a text message. Darling, then a line of code. Numbers and letters, but the meaning? Or is the message empty, the code impossible to crack, it's only communication, keep thinking. Holding on. If you work too hard on anything, it turns to shit. Children sculpting with Play-Doh, not knowing when to walk away, all colors to brown. A woman seated on the edge of a subway bench placed her index finger against the wall as if to balance as the subway careened into a sharp turn. I feel that way today. I'm using a mere digit to try and exert some control over a situation that leaves me powerless. Unknowing, an unmoored particle in space. Then how do you account for your being childlike, he asked. Have you thought about that? The gyroscopic function of unconscious fantasy. The main thing it balances is shame. That's what really throws us off. The moral is, of course, don't write one-act plays. Move towards what you believe in, and the person you are steps through. Punctuation of grief.
Thank you. So that is your autobiography. I actually was just remembering as you read it how much I loved the observation about Plato and how exactly right it seemed, you know, that that scene when creating, you know, in front of some perspective, Plato will plasticine creation, that this time every colour will be perfectly differentiated and will adhere only to its own object, and the kind of dawning inevitable disappointment that the chaos of undifferentiation will kind of absorb this monstrous creature that looks like nothing like what you'd hope. Anyway, that's really by the by. It's not a way into a question or anything, it's just a thought. But
Should we take questions?
Yeah, we should. I mean, I was going to just say, ask you something, maybe somebody else wants to ask you something about the place of quotation in the book.
Oh, yeah.
Because there is that wonderful passage about being the life and soul of the party, which does in fact have an attribution. So I'm not giving it away because it's there.
It's from Kierkegaard's notebook. What I did with the, there are a number of quotations in the book, and I don't cite them for the most part within the book, and I also use my memories version of them, and then I correct them in the notes. And in the notes, I cite everything, and I correct all my misrememberings, but they're usually quotations that I feel like I really wrote, because I know them so well and I'm so close to them. And, of course, I have to acknowledge that I didn't. It is Kierkegaard's.
Yeah, but I mean...
But I feel that way about... There's, like, one Sylvia Plath poem, Sheep in a Fog. I really feel like it should be mine. I feel so close to it. And I know it's hers, and I acknowledge it's hers, but...
So we are back with the Valedo, though. We are back with the Valedo,
yeah.
Okay. Let's start with questions.
So I've made notes because there's lots of things that sort of add up here. I was thinking about the point we started with, which is this point P in the fourth dimension and everything that could happen after that point and everything that's possibly here to make that point exist. And it seems like there's lots of things to do with like endings, like when you spit something out, it's like finished being in you. And when you and then you feel ashamed of writing a poem, probably not when you're in the act of writing it, but only when it's finished. And then there's things like this autobiography which you didn't finish, and like when you're teaching and you're giving a class, it's fine. And then if somebody tells you something that you said in it that you feel like deeply ashamed of it for some reason, readings, parties, all these things, it's like when you have to look back at it. When you're writing your book, do you feel ashamed of it? Did you feel ashamed of it while you're writing it, or only when you finished it? And also, do you think that, like, the point of finishing a poem is kind of a welcome, like almost like coming to terms with the shame that it's already going to bring you? That's two difficult questions. So.
Those are really, really interesting questions. The first one, because I wrote it out of a hole, I wrote it so quickly. I used the material I had, but I really put it together, and I didn't show it to anyone as I was writing it, and I think that was very liberating because it kind of stayed inside my body. But then once, and I only showed it to a few people actually up until a few weeks ago when it came out. So it really wasn't, I didn't pass it around and get many people's opinions on it. And so, a few weeks before it came out, I went a little bit crazy, and I felt so deeply, deeply ashamed of it, and I really felt like it was out there, and I couldn't pull it back in, and that was when I really felt it. And then once it actually existed, I could handle it, but it was in the weeks before, as it was in production, that I was losing it.
Would you be able to talk about it without shame while you're writing it, like if it's an ongoing project, like you're book about laughter, but is it the finishing that has something to do? The irrecoverable moment of finishing?
I think when I was writing it, I didn't talk about it, so I don't know for this. The Book of Laughter, I feel ashamed about when I talk about it, but mostly because I haven't finished it yet. And I feel like I've been talking about it for so long that if anybody knows me, I can't bring it up because they'll be like, you're still working on that book? Will you ever really write it? But, yeah, I always feel a little bit... There's also something that's lost when you talk about it. I think that could go into the work. I'm always afraid that something seeps out. But the something you said made me think also about... There's this... the second law of thermodynamics has this corollary where it talks about how energy is never lost, but it's only transformed. And it's similar to water. Like, water doesn't disappear, it gets transformed, and that happens over time. And so if you think about where water was before it reached you and how we've all commingled in so many ways, or our blood, where the water that's in our blood has been somewhere else. I think there is this, and I don't remember exactly what you said that made me suddenly think of that, but that's, I don't remember because I have so much adrenaline right now. I can't go back to it. But what was the second question?
I think the first was just about endings. Do you feel like ashamed? It seemed like all these things were about that. Once you have that thing, once you pass the point P, then you have to commit to it or something like that. That's spitting.
Well, I think the idea of that is that it keeps going because things are always moving from the elsewhere into your future light cone, and things are always going into emerging from the past, and so it's more continuous. But I do think there's something interesting about endings. They are embarrassing. And Susan Sontag has this book, Against Interpretation, and in it she talks about, she calls for an erotics of art, and she kind of uses an analogy to sexual consummation as art that is programmatic and resolves, like program music or, you know, those films that have the happy ending. And whereas the higher art is the art that is doesn't resolve, but it's endlessly erotic, so it's constantly stimulating you. And there is a sense, if you go to a movie that is high art, that you won't get it. You have to keep thinking about it. And there is that provocation, and it's a constant provocation. And there is something about consummation that is embarrassing in some way, I think.
I have a sort of follow-up question to that. I was really struck by the image of the cricket eating its own viscera, and I wondered if there was some link to the sort of shame of the producing a poem or something, which is something I really related to, that there's also a sense in which you're kind of feeding on your own viscera when you publish something, and it goes out into the world, and, you know, you might do events, or, you know, receive sort of responses of various kinds.
And that's a critical accusation people have of poets, that they're using something from their life and they're like feeding off of their own viscera and transforming it into a poem. It's something that's both generative, as the entomologist said, in nature, it's a form of survival, but then we can, if a poet doesn't seem adequately ashamed of it, then the critique will often be, well, there you are, feeding off of your viscera, writing a confessional poem.
It is interesting. It's so different, though, from the kinds of accusation that get chucked at, say, an autobiographical novel. Because I tend to find that the discourse around that is always that there's something kind of crafty and manipulative, and, you know, the use that you're talking about is very kind of calculated, and about sort of catapulting the novelist to fame. Whereas with the poet, the accusation is a different kind of narcissism. It's a way you're sort of putting yourself on display, kind of naked, you know, that it's an exhibitionism, which is very different from the kind of the charge of exploitation that you often get against novelists who use their
life. So unfair.
It's very unfair.
Yeah. Isn't there something very sort of common ground between good poetry and good psychoanalysis, that neither of them are necessarily about mastery, and it's about what you can make of something rather than ever sort of putting it on the couch and having a finished version? Are always very sort of temporary in the ideas of that. And that the best psychoanalysis is about constantly opening up and about fluidity and thinking that there is something ultimately, like Laplanche, sort of an enigmatic something at the heart of the matter that we're never going to be able to think that we know.
You can have a momentary moment of knowledge, but then, and it kind of goes back to your question about endings.
Moments of insight, but not full knowledge.
Yeah, even when you end an analysis, termination, there's really no right time. It's just usually circumstances or there's some reason that somebody terminates. And, I mean, I don't know. I haven't experienced a natural termination.
No.
In fact, well, here's the other day while I was here in London, to become an analyst, you have to be in analysis. So I was in a long analysis as I was training, and I terminated, though not because I was done, but for other reasons, mostly because I really wanted the time, because it takes a lot of time. And I felt like it was going to be a while before I could go to another level, so I can always go back in. But randomly, I was getting ready to meet someone, and my phone rang, and it was my analyst. And I terminated a while ago, and she said, "Did you just call me?" And I said, "No, I'm in London." And she said, "Oh, it appeared on my phone that you had called me." And I said, "Well, I've been thinking about you, but I didn't call you." And it was such an interesting provocation to go back to that word, because she's in my mythology, so I'm always, it ended, but it never ended. There was no end. It just closed for a while.
There isn't a right time to end, although I think it can feel like there's a wrong time to end. I mean, there has to be a wrong time to end. But the discussion around it, just to pick up on James's point, seems so close to the discussion of why you decide to end a poem or a painting. You know, there is nothing that authorizes you definitively to say it's finished. There's always something else you can do. But there's also something, I mean, you say...
Well, then you don't want it to be like the Play-Doh and turn into shit.
Right, that's true. But also you say, you know, and I'm really not sure about this, but you say, it wasn't because I was so ready to end, but I needed the time. But
well, I'm also telling that to the crowd.
Sure, that's your cover story.
Yeah.
But
it was an easy thing to say,
right,
so
yeah.
I went for it.
Yeah. But is the point where you think you need the time or the analysis, more than the analysis, one way of deciding you're ready?
Or maybe with ending a poem. Maybe you need the sandwich more than you need to write more.
Yeah.
I used to, when I first started writing poems, I used to love writing them on planes. And I remember I wasn't so good at getting back into a poem, so all of my poems would end when the meal arrived. And then if someone asked me, "Why didn't you go on?" I'd say, "I don't know."
So, I mean, in writing, food and beverage, I mean, in the practice of writing, food and beverage awards, I think, or rewards, are incredibly important. They've organized a writing day. Very good.
I was going to ask whether the writing in the fourth person is a way of keeping the shame at home.
Definitely. Or trying to write in the fourth person, although I have to say, I feel like my book, it has a lot of viscera oozing out of it at the same time. And I was trying to think before tonight, I was thinking, okay, which poems are the ones I'm most ashamed of? And I didn't know whether I should go for them or stay away from them. But the ones that I'm most ashamed of are the ones that I think people relate the most to. And I think that there is, you know, if you really try to clean it up, it would be like a Facebook profile, you know.
Do you think of it
as a life?
Yeah. Do you think of it as one poem?
I think of it as a book. Mm. I don't really think of it as a series of poems, but I do think it's in parts. With my first book, I felt like it was a collection of poems, but it wasn't really a book. And this time I really wanted a book. And I didn't know exactly what that meant. And then I ended up with a book, but not necessarily a collection of poems.
Can I just ask out of curiosity about the redactions, you know, the clarity? So that there are words underneath all the redactions, yeah?
Yeah.
And
typesetter knows the words.
And some you can see. Sometimes you
some,
can,
yeah.
You can see, you can have to see that.
And you
yeah.
can see, yeah. say, for example, with a lowercase h, you can see the h.
Yeah.
And there's one name in one where I think you can make it out because the...
Yeah.
Which
yeah,
I yeah, realized yeah, later. Yeah. It's my, I mean, it's my friend's partner, so I just, I felt like I definitely wanted it redacted so it wouldn't seem like I was somehow
no, you actually said it was, but you actually said it was arbitrary.
I wanted it, I invited the intern to make it arbitrary.
But before you did that, where did the, I don't know, where did the redaction, you know, where did that enter into the text, as it were, what motivated this?
I think I understand your question. So first I chose what were going to be the fragments that were going to be redacted completely or partially. I had invited the intern to redact randomly, but she didn't take me up on that for whatever reason. She said she didn't understand that that's what I'd offered. Maybe I didn't make it clear enough. So then what I did was all of the redactions, those sections that I chose for redactions, are things that are super, super vulnerable. Things that I needed in the book to make the book complete, but I couldn't put in the book completely. And so there's a last line of the first long poem of fragments that says, the redactions are closest to my heart. And it's true. And they're also are closer. The redactions are closer to my heart. And what's beneath there, I feel, is absolutely necessary, but I couldn't bear.
Where you can see the words beneath the redactions, you kind of find yourself doing this, which brings in a kind of very felt way, the experience of intrusiveness. In a way, the shame is passed on to the reader, because they're looking through a keyhole at that point. They're exposed to their own nastiness. There's this great passage in Sartre's Being and Nothingness where he says, you know, you're in control when you're looking through the keyhole at the couple, and then somebody passes you in the corridor.
That's such a great image.
Yeah.
Behind.
I was just going to say,
you know,
when you said that thing about the poems that you most ashamed of, I wanted to ask you, is shame the new pride?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
I was thinking also when we were talking earlier about shame and shamelessness of the Brexit campaign being very much something that this country seems to be very wrapped up in notions of shame, and that Brexit is very shame driven. Then we had the referendum and it seemed like we passed into shamelessness in the way we, you know, embraced that decision, and all the people that I asked if they were considering voting for Brexit or not, were often displays of feelings of shame until after the moment of, you know, the termination moment of referendum, which became shameless.
And our comparable experience in America would be Trump and his presidency. And he's actually often called a clown. And, I mean, one of the things about a clown also is I've been told, I've never studied with Philippe Gollier, but I've been told that he says, you have to think you're really beautiful to take the stage. And if you don't want to get up there and believe that you're beautiful, then get off the stage. And maybe that's one of the things about Trump, because he really thinks he's beautiful. You know, he really believes it when he's up there. Whatever we think of him when we look at him, he has that ability to enjoy being looked at and to keep standing.
Well, first I was going to ask, is that a shame of being shameless, that you should kind of sometimes have some shame? But also, with the redactions, why did you not go one way or the other, have the things that are taken out completely out, or completely blacked out, so you can't see a single thing, or that you can still see them? Why was it in the middle? Was that distracting, or was it deliberate or anything like that?
To answer the first question, I think that you have to be really narcissistic not to feel shame if it involves looking at yourself through the perspective of another, because the acknowledgement of another person's perspective is necessary in living with other people in the world. So I think, not that one should feel ashamed, but one should try to... Empathy also, the German called feeling into the shape of another. You've got to make that move in order to see beyond yourself. So I don't think shamelessness is necessarily a good thing. And the second question, with the redactions, I think that because I was in that hole writing the book, I was also in an insular logic, and one of the things I was thinking about, I also have glosses, kind of like little things in the margin, and I was thinking of it as not part of the direct line of the reader's narrative, but coming in from the elsewhere. And in some way I thought of the redactions also as being partially there, the way there are always things partially in our minds, even if we can only grab a little of them, or we only get pieces of them, or when you wake up from a dream, you can have snippets, but not the whole dream. And I think the mind works that way. Even with repression, nothing gets completely repressed. You usually, Freud talked about screen memories. It's like the way his dream theory worked, you have two parts of a dream. I'm going to try to simplify it to make it quick. So you have two parts of a dream, one part that is kind of the image container and the other part that's uncharged, and the other part that's the emotion that's connected to it that's highly charged. You split off the emotion that's charged and repress it, and then the empty container of the image goes into the dream to remix with other things. And that's why you can have it in the dream, because it doesn't have the feeling that's going to disturb you and wake you up, because the whole point of sleep is to keep you asleep, or the sensor is trying to keep you asleep. So I think in screen memories it works similarly, that you have a part of a memory that you can hold on to and carry into your life and keep in your mind because it's neutral, but then the part of the memory that you had to turn away from and gets repressed is screened out by the part that you allow to continue to exist in your mind. So it's a way of remembering and not remembering, and knowing and not knowing. And I've always been fascinated with that state.
Do you feel shame about your writing differently here in New York?
Definitely, because that's a question that's usually asked kind of differently, which is, why do you publish in the UK and not in the States? I think I do, and some of it is circumstance, but I do, in a way. I'm less vulnerable. I would have to think about exactly why, but part of it is because I'm a foreigner. So I'm already alien. And so the things that are alien in me are already marked or contained. It's sort of like the frame in psychoanalysis. It gives it a frame that it's going to be 45 minutes, and you know exactly where you're going to lie down and what's going to happen. And in some way, by coming in as an alien foreigner, I have the frame of, I'm already different. And so all of my weirdnesses, yeah, it goes with the territory.
It's kind of a version of the, you know, the fourth person singular's arm's length. Although I thought that was complicated, because the arm's length is also the saliva out there. I mean, so in other words, it keeps the chain at bay, but at the same time, it intensifies it, because you then have to see it objectified. To see something at arm's length is actually to see it in a way you wouldn't want to see it.
I think it depends on what it is. Like, what the viscera doesn't come from it. Not everything is viscera, so I feel like we're out of time, but I'll say really quickly. I have these night fragments in the book, which are fragments. I kept a notebook by the side of my bed and set my alarm for 3:15 a.m. and each night for a period I would wake up and write down whatever was on the top of my mind. And it wasn't dream material. It was to access the syntax and images of my unconscious. And I mean, so much more interesting than I am, unfortunately. But when I do, when I have some of the night fragments in the book, I don't feel ashamed of those because they're from my unconscious. So that I feel like I'm not responsible for those thoughts. You know, whereas I feel differently about the more organized versions of things. I'm more vulnerable.
I think we have time for one more question.
I think you're very right about how when sometimes you try to create something honest, something raw, it really feels like you're spitting saliva into a cup. Maybe I wondered if we actually, all of us, imagine when we spit into a cup that our spit would actually come out like a professional diver and very elegantly dive into the glass and make a splash there and echo, but it really doesn't. But I think you also know that sometimes there's this power to this sense of honesty, sense of vulnerability, that it is what it is. And I also wondered if you, as you spit in the glass, if you also imagine the other person sitting opposite to you would look at it and then spit into the glass as well, as a kind of, yes, I also have spit inside of me, and when I, sometimes it just comes out, then that's what it is. And if that thought actually comforts you sometimes and let you be, somehow allows you to sort of become more tender towards that sense of shame.
It's interesting that you say that, because in Clown, so many of the exercises involve taking what makes us ashamed and turning it into a game. So everything that's icky about you, you then run around and chase people with. And it's one of those theater games. I don't know if any of you have taken theater class. But it is about trying to normalize that so that we all acknowledge we all have it inside of us.
Yeah, I think sometimes when we face these wobbly parts of ourselves, we learn to name them. We learn to clarify what it is that we're trying to say or share with somebody else. But when it comes to emotions or these icky things, sometimes it's hard to find a name for it. And when you name them at that moment, you feel that you're lying, because that isn't what it is. And I think this, what Clowns do is, it's really saying that it's okay that sometimes you experience something and it's nameless and it's wobbly and it's brown.
Yeah.
But it's fine. It's okay.
Okay. Yes. Absolutely. It's a great note on which to
let it be
wobbliness later. It actually hasn't felt like too Play-Doh, like just Play-Doh-like enough, this dialogue. And for me, the measure of it really is that it can be difficult doing these things, but for me it has gone by very quickly, and it's been a very rich discussion, because there's so much that this book provokes, and I feel like I kind of understand it better and I'm more puzzled by it at the end of this discussion. So I invite you to experience the same thing by coming and buying it afterwards. Otherwise, really, thank you all of you, and especially, of course, thank you, Noah.